Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Artist Lynn Myers creates works that reveal the expansive potential of drawing. In monumental installations drawn straight onto the wall and smaller works of ink on panel or mylar, Myers uses simple designs and delicate handling of materials to make rhythm visible in drawings of astonishing detail. That Myers works alone, even on the 400-foot-long Our View from Here, made in 2017 at the Hirshhorn Museum, means these drawings also materialize her extensive labor, recording not only Myers' skill, but also her capability for extreme endurance. With fellow Washington, D.C.-based artists Tim Dowd and Caitlin Teal Price, Myers is a co-founder of Stable, a local studio complex that provides visual artists an active, affordable workspace to pursue their profession. In this conversation, recorded at the National Gallery of Art on December 9, 2018, Myers and Jonathan Frederick Waltz, Director of Curatorial Affairs and Curator of American Art at the Columbus Museum, discusses the artist's practice and institutional collaborations to celebrate the publication of her monograph, Lynn Myers, Works 2004-2018.
Gosh, thank you all for being here. It's really a privilege to be interviewing such an amazing artist in such an amazing place. Thank you. Just a moment, a word about our format. Lynn has looped just a lot of images. We won't be speaking about any particular one, although we do have the capability if we need to stop and focus on something, but those will just be looping as we're talking. And we'll talk about 40 minutes or so, but we definitely would like to take questions from the audience, so be thinking of some good questions as we're interviewing each other. I thought we would start by just talking about how we first met and got to work with each other. I really have to give a shout out to Douglas Whitmer because I was curating a show at the University of Maryland when I was a graduate school and knew that I wanted to work with Douglas Whitmer, who's a minimalist painter in Philadelphia. And he said that a dream of his was always to do a project with you. So you were quickly added to the roster, and it's been great since 2007 when that happened. We've stayed in touch, and since that time, at my previous job at Sheldon Museum of Art, we acquired one of Lynn's untitled Mylar drawings in 2014. We also investigated at that time a potential wall drawing, which unfortunately was left unrealized. But that energy then folded into the project that we've just completed, more or less. Lynn was at the Columbus Museum in Columbus, Georgia in early January of this year, where she spent about 10 days creating a large wall painting called Gazing Has Its Limits. So that transpired early this year. And then as part of that, and the reason why we're here today is that as an auxiliary aspect of the wall painting at the museum, that was a great opportunity to work with Radius Books in Santa Fe on a large monograph overview of Lynn's career to date. So the book that we'll be selling and signing outside includes work from 2004 all the way up through Gazing Has Its Limits and the wall drawing that Bowdoin College commissioned that Lynn completed in September. So speaking of Radius, we want to say thank you. It's like just such a beautiful publication. I was thinking on the metro, it's almost, I don't know how this would be possible, but it's almost more beautiful somehow. and it's very affordable, so if folks can't afford an original, they can at least have this very beautiful object in their library. The book and the wall drawing at the Columbus Museum received internal exhibition funding, but the museum also is a co-publisher of the book, so just a shout out to my institution of employ. Lynn's colleague Jason Hamm also helped fund the publication, and we want to give a shout out as well to Marc Olivier and Marlene Debota Olivier and the W.C. Bradley Company. Really, without their support and vision for contemporary art in Columbus, really, I don't think any of this would have happened. So we owe them a debt. Linda and I were speaking yesterday, and there are sort of four key words that she often feels come up in conversation about her work. So I thought I would just mention those, and we can put a pin in them, though I think both in terms of our conversation, they'll come up, but they also might be prompts as you listen, and they might prompt questions in your own mind. So I just thought I would mention issues that bubble to the surface, sensation, which I think also relates to being embodied, entropy, ephemerality, which is something I want to talk about, and labor is the fourth one. I wanted to add a fifth because of our amazing conversation yesterday, or Friday, attention. I think that's a really important concept, both in terms of how you make your work, but also how viewers experience your work. And I think that would be definitely worthwhile talking about. So I thought we'd kick off. For my last job, we were working on a catalog about drawings in the collection. So I had the opportunity to work on the new acquisition that we made, your Mylar drawing. And as I was working on it, up to that time, some of the writing about your work really honed in on this idea that you had been grappling with about imperfection, and also sort of the idea of failure, but how failure can actually be productive, right? And I scribbled down here earlier this afternoon, our imperfections are what make us human. So I thought if you could maybe, since that's such a important, both in terms of how you think about your work, but how other people have written about your work, I thought maybe we could just talk a little bit about that.
So where to start with that? That's a big one.
So I think a mental image I often have is your residency at Bemis in Omaha, where you were sort of setting yourself this task of filling a Mylar sheet with these straight lines. Right. But in fact, as you were, that was sort of your equation ahead of time, but as you were enacting it, you were finding that actually drawing a straight line is impossible in a certain sense.
Right, and I think I knew that going into it, going into those drawings, which I referred to as gravity drawings, because my the kind of structure that I set up around making them was very simple, and it was really to allow gravity to draw the line rather than my body. Mm-hmm. But the body interferes. But as we were discussing those on Friday, we were talking about the way in which, as I got better at making straight lines, the works themselves got less and less interesting. So don't get too good at anything. But I also wanted to just acknowledge that this idea of kind of leaning on failure is something that is a privilege. Hmm. And that it's easy to take that for granted.
Totally, yeah. Yeah. Especially having the time, energy, resources to step back and really think about what you learned, even though you failed, it's not a complete failure in the sense that you've learned something, right? And often folks who fail don't have that opportunity to be mindful.
Exactly. Of, yeah. And we're also only discussing failure in terms of art making.
Right.
But I don't, you know, I mean, even like I just painted over a painting the other day that I spent, I don't know how many dozens of hours making. And it's hanging on the wall. I should have pointed it out to you when you were over, but I don't really consider it a failure because it's the painting that's underneath of the field of color that's on top of it. Will impact what I make next.
Absolutely.
So even though nobody except for me will ever know what that looked like under there. It's still part of the structure of the piece that's driving it forward.
So this is very topical because did you look at the Bryce Spartan yesterday at Glenstone, or had you seen that piece before?
I hadn't seen that piece before.
Because if you went up to the colors on the sides, there was the drawings that he had then covered
over
with the color. So very much along the lines of what you're saying about the process of underneath really informing what happens. It's so interesting, like you could just see this palimpsest though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of paintings are like that, right?
Sure.
And I guess one of the things that we talked about as we were preparing for this conversation, one of the things was the difference between painting and drawing, because I was almost exclusively a drawing artist for so many years. And began painting again. What did we decide?
It was around
maybe 2010, I think, really. But more and more since then. But really, that's one thing that a painting allows in a way that my drawings didn't, and specifically my drawings, because I didn't use erasure. That I was drawing with ink. So. The marks that I put down stayed, and with the paintings, there are always layers. Very few of my works kind of happen on the first try.
So since you've brought that up, I have to say that actually Marlene at Columbus Museum, I kept calling your work a wall drawing, partly because of our past together and having worked with you on other occasions. And she kept asking me, like, why do you call it a wall drawing? So there was kind of this moment where I had to, I think I do it in the essay for the monograph, kind of unpack, like, that you've made this transition, and it's sort of an easy shorthand for a curator to just call it a wall drawing. But maybe talk a little bit about that transition, because you were so identified with that and also identifying with it in your practice, and then you made this transition.
I mean, I do think of the piece at Columbus as a wall drawing, even though there's a big chunk of it that was painted. And I don't know how many of you noticed the text at the bottom. It's the one with the big dark shape. And that shape was painted before I began making the marks on top of it, and the marks I think of as drawing.
Yep.
Pure and simple.
Yep. Yep.
There's no denying that the painted part is a painting.
Right.
But for whatever reason, it doesn't have the same, the experience of making it was more like making a drawing. And we talked about this the other day also, that you can draw with paint.
Yeah.
So it's not the material itself that determines what the piece, how you identify the action taken, right? So what were we talking about?
The transition.
The transition.
Yeah. Because I remember there was this moment where you were like, I think I'm painting again.
Yeah.
It's really weird.
So that really began happening while I was working on my project at the Phillips Collection. I think of, so that the project at the Phillips Collection was part of their Intersections program, and with that program they've asked contemporary artists to reflect on works from their permanent collection and make works in response. And so the piece that I chose to reflect on is a Van Gogh painting called The Road Menders. And while I was working in the museum, I asked them to move the road menders so that I could see that while I was looking at my own work, so that I could kind of have a true experience of going back and forth.
Yeah.
And it's almost like Van Gogh got up in my business while I was working there. And I found that the wall drawing was becoming a little bit more painterly. And I began to contemplate the differences between the act of drawing, the act of painting, And it was when I went back into my studio after completing that project that I began to allow painting back in a bit. But it really took years before it got a full hold on me. And at this point, I'm doing, in the studio, more painting than drawing.
Yeah. So that's a great segue to mention that you kind of work in two different ways these days, at least. You have the more discrete object type things that you're making, whether it's a painting or a drawing on Mylar or some kind of combination.
Or print.
Yes, that's right. You're a distinguished printmaker as well. And then, so I guess maybe three ways. And then these large wall drawings / wall paintings. So I thought, since a drawing that one can handle is a little more familiar, but your work isn't on view here right now, folks might not be familiar with those large scale projects. So I wondered if you could just talk through the steps a little bit, kind of how you come about to make them. And I think we'll get to ephemerality then.
That way, yeah. I told Jonathan the story of seeing a Richard Wright wall drawing in a gallery in New York years ago, and it was before wall drawing was really a part of my practice, and I was shocked by it because I had so many questions, like how could this have been made right here, and what's going to happen to it? And I kind of forgot about that experience, and years went by, and then I began making wall drawings, and for me, all of those questions that I had with Wright's work, of course, don't come up for my own work, but I recognize that they do come up for viewers. So the wall drawings that I make, like this piece, do require a lot of planning beforehand. Even though they're entirely freehand once I'm working on site, there are generally dozens of preparatory drawings that get made, and you know, it's not, I usually wouldn't walk into a space and know immediately what I want to make. It sort of takes a while to work through different ideas.
I think that was something I was really struck by, especially when we were considering at Sheldon, is like you really moved throughout the museum. You were there for the good part of a day and thinking about where light hits and where the sun comes in and traffic patterns, that kind of thing. So you're really responding to the space. You're not imposing so much. It's really a kind of a dialogue where you're finding the place the drawing is going to perform
exactly.
The best.
Yeah. So it's the architecture that drives the kind of initial plan. And so that happens during site visits. And then there's the preparatory work that happens in the studio. And that includes scaled drawings that oftentimes start in one place and end up someplace entirely different by the time I'm ready to install. There are color studies. I'm trying to think what the other prep work is that I do. Anyway.
Sort of thinking through your marks, too, because you have a repertoire at this point. So.
Exactly. Yeah. And then there are changes that happen on site. So, for instance, with the Columbus Museum project, I made a kind of, in my mind, significant shift in the piece as it's one thing to contemplate the space while you're sitting in the space. It's in it. And that shifts when you're working in the space. So then my experience of it changes.
Absolutely.
And in the case of the Columbus Museum install and Bowdoin also, I made some editorial decisions while I was installing.
Yeah. So I addressed this in the essay that I wrote for the monograph. And you know, being immersed in the art world and having learned a lot about art history and thinking about process projects or happenings or performance art where there's a very definite beginning and end. But I think in terms of media maybe, or styles that are more closely related to sort of more familiar kinds of objects. It just really struck me, especially at the Columbus Museum, that I knew going into it, because of course this is part of your process, but also, you know, we have a contract that says the piece has a very specific beginning and a very specific end. And talking to all of the committees that I had to talk to get the project approved, and then giving training to docents and that kind of thing, there was really a lot of consternation about the fact that this would go away. And I find that that really adds this poignancy to the piece, in that I won't always have access to this, that I have to really take advantage of it while it's on view, while it exists. And maybe sort of talk about your relationship with that decision, because...
Right, you know. And that just, you just made me think of that, you know, that paying attention. Mm. Yes, yeah. There's, I mean, we think of objects as being precious, but when you no longer have it, it's that much more precious, or in your mind it is. Or,
right.
And then there's that quote about attention being the greatest form of generosity. I don't want the work to be impermanent, to disturb people. But it's very important to me that's impermanent, and it shifts the way that I look at it. And I would hope that it might shift the way other people look at it. I mean, I know that referring back to that experience of seeing that Richard Wright wall drawing, that it really rocked me. And it's a privilege to have the opportunity to maybe be able to do that for some viewers. I mean, I'm sure my memory of that Richard Wright piece is totally skewed, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because it's also the memory of my reaction to it and how that reaction changed me. And I think that is part of the title of the piece at the Columbus Museum. We've actually not really talked about this, but gazing has its limits. You know, there's more to it than looking.
Right.
And that speaks to sensation and ephemerality and,
So that ephemerality really also speaks to, you know, there's a kind of ethics behind these wall drawings, mm-hmm. that when you started thinking about even doing them and then proceeded with doing them, you're really not making an object in a sense that somebody can buy it and take it home with them. And that was very conscious on your part.
Yes, and the first wall drawing that I did with that in mind was in the studio. So not only was it not an object, not only was it not something that could change hands, but it was also something that was pretty private, because I don't have a lot of people come over to the studio.
Right.
It was an experiment. I wanted to see what it felt like to respond to the architecture in that way. Because I had done one other wall drawing back in, I think it was late 2000, that was for a group show called 8-Hour Drawing at a university in Pennsylvania. And so each artist had a kind of section of the wall, and we were asked to come in and make a piece. Everybody was working at once. And in that case, it was really more about just using the wall as the substrate rather than a canvas or a piece of paper. So I don't really, in my mind, that piece doesn't really fall into the same category as the other wall drawings that I've done. Mm-hmm. But the piece in the studio was pivotal, and it actually stayed up on the studio wall for many years. I had other works pinned on top of it for a while until I finally needed to say goodbye to it. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't keeping it around because I was attached to it. It was more just laziness. I didn't feel like painting the wall. But that piece got something out of my system about, I really wanted to make something that wasn't an object, but I love painting and drawing so much that it took me a while to figure out how I could do that. Do you hear that feedback?
I think it's that.
Okay, yeah. And so after I made that piece, I was lucky enough to be invited to make works that were less private, wall drawings that were less private. And I began to understand that architecture could play such a grand role in the way that the pieces evolved.
I'm glad you brought up privacy because there is, and this is related to labor, in the sense that when you make them now, these large scale interventions in architecture, you're doing it very publicly, mm-hmm. which is very different from when you did it for yourself in the studio.
Yeah.
And for us, one reason why we invited you is that we were planning a whole season around the themes of work, labor, and endurance. And your work just immediately came to mind as someone who grapples with those issues all the time. And so I think it was really revelatory for our audience to sort of have a chance to see someone making something right before their eyes. Because, you know, there's like that magic thing where the work just shows up on the wall and like, how did that happen, right? And so you're really sort of demystifying that in a sense.
You're making me think of how I was installing my piece at the Hirshhorn at the same time that the Robert Irwin show was being installed, and how the second floor of the museum was closed to visitors. And while they were installing the Irwin show. And for those of you here who saw that exhibition, there was a piece called, I think it was called Squaring the Circle, and it was this giant scrim that he installed. It was very, very complicated, labor-intensive mm-hmm. installation, mm-hmm. all done in secrecy. And like, I got to part the curtain and look in a little bit, but for the most part, it was one of those things where the exhibition opened and it was sort of like a
fait accompli.
Right. Yeah. The exhibition opened, the Irwin piece was done, and I was still out in the other gallery scrapping around on the floor, painting, drawing on the wall. And so there was this real kind of juxtaposition between the way that audiences experienced the Irwin show, which was both objects and a site-specific work, and the way they experienced my exhibition, which was still in process. Mm-hmm. And I was there every single day working on it, and it was changing every day. I do love that. I mean, I'm not a performance artist in any way, but I like the generosity of it.
Yeah. That brings up too that you have a background in dance, and so you're very aware of your body and space, resistance, different positions that you move in. And I find, like, I didn't know that till just a little while ago. But I was like, wow, that just makes so much sense because of the very physical way that you make the large work.
Yeah, and I'm also very aware of sort of the sweep of gesture and how the work that I make in preparation for the site-specific projects is made with my wrist, and how the larger works are made with my full body, and how that those gestures impact how the images evolve.
There was a series where you were sort of drawing as sort of far as you could reach or something.
There was one piece that I made that years and years ago where I stood on my tippy toes and drew a line from as high as I could reach all the way down, which isn't anything new. I think many artists have done that. There's a piece where I drew It was a set space, so I think it was like maybe 8 or 9 feet wide, a continuous horizontal line all the way across. The piece that the Hirshhorn owns that I think is in this in these slides was drawn similarly to that, except for as the lines, I started at the bottom, and as I worked my way up, the lines began to sort of organically curve up at the sides. I think just the proximity of one line to the next changed on the edges less so in the middle. And so as the lines began to curve, it demanded a break in the line. I had to reposition. I think I got stuck and I had to reposition my arm, which meant that there were little gaps here and there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was really struck rereading my catalog entry for the Sheldon Museum, and also visiting the studio and then seeing slides today, that you often come up with a structure that you're sort of working against. So the Hirshhorn has like these circles and arcs that go with it, and those were similar to in the Sheldon piece. So I'm curious how you come up with, how you decide what sort of structure to, and maybe it's an unanswerable question, but there are often these sort of underlying geometric or related forms that you're then responding to.
Right, so I think, well, with the site-specific works, the architecture is generally provides some place to start, and it provides some hard edges. Mm-hmm. With the works in the studio, I often add a geometric element to give myself something to push up against. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was something I was going to say in response to that, but it slipped my mind, so we'll
it'll come back to it.
Yeah.
I'm also intrigued by, like as minimal as you are, I think of you as this amazing colorist. So how do you, it might be instructive for the audience, like how do you like settle on a particular, Is it about the architecture again, or?
I think with the palette of the, you're talking about the wall drawings.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes. Well, it would definitely the first element that I would contemplate in terms of palette. Well, in terms of making decisions, would be the environment and the architecture. With the Hammer Museum, it became more about the city of Los Angeles and the light. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes I don't spend enough time in a city to really have a deep sense of that. I did a piece in Paris in 2010 that I lived in Paris briefly when I was younger, so I did have a sense of the light there and the city and the kind of grittiness of it in the wintertime, which is when I was making the piece, and that informed the palette of that piece. With the Hirshhorn, there is actually a fair amount of color in that space to begin with, so I used that as a starting point. With the Columbus Museum project, I really just wanted to, we've talked about this a bit, but I had this idea of creating this big void in this gigantic flat surface, which didn't necessarily work out, but that was a successful failure in my mind.
So far, two of your monumental projects have had some kind of sound component, and I'm really curious about how that occurred to you, at the University of Maryland installation, that was a single person, I think. For the Bowdoin project, you worked with a team. Mm-hmm. So maybe talk a little bit about your relationship to sound.
So the project at the University of Maryland was a collaboration with an artist named Richard Chartier, who is from the area at the time, lived here, is now living in Los Angeles. And he makes synthetic compositions. He really wanted to do something together. We had a multitude of ideas and had been talking about it for years, actually. Mm. And then when the University of Maryland exhibition presented itself, what made our collaboration a possibility was that in that exhibition, I actually designed the architecture. Mm-hmm. So that those pieces were different. I did two large wall drawings for that show, and those pieces were different than other wall drawings that I've made because I was initiating the architecture. Sure. And so the piece that Richard and I made together was a kind of chevron-shaped wall, and the back of the wall was not accessible to visitors, and he put transducers on the back of the sheetrock and basically turned the wall into a giant speaker. And so that was our plan. I think I designed the wall, and then he designed how the sound would be installed in it. And then I came up with an initial idea for what the wall drawing would look like. He composed his composition, and then once I heard it, I responded to it by shifting my plans for the wall drawing a bit. Hmm. Not significantly, but it was mostly in terms of the palette, actually, because I felt that the colors I had originally planned on using didn't make sense with the sound that he had designed. Hmm. So that was how that back and forth happened. The project at Bowdoin was really much more woven together, the way that I worked with the other artists. Mm-hmm. So so it's Rebecca Bray, James Bigby Garver, and Josh Knowles. And James Garver is a sound artist. Rebecca is an audience design or audience experience specialist and an installation artist. And Josh Knowles has a background in music, but he's also a software designer and a game designer. And so the four of us really worked together for a couple years to figure out, we knew we wanted to make something that was unfinished that would allow visitors to complete the piece, but we didn't know what that would look like. Mm-hmm. And from the very start, we figured it was an app. Because we're all aware, especially Rebecca, having worked here at the Natural History Museum, you know, all museums are grappling with how to deal with visitors using their smartphones, and whether you try and like shut the signal down in the galleries or encourage them to use the phone to learn more or whatever. So we decided we would encourage visitors to use their smartphone to complete the piece. Mm-hmm. And so that that project is called Listening Glass, and it is it goes along with this piece, which is called Let's Get Lost. So Let's Get Lost is a finished work. It's a wall drawing. Listening Glass is a audience participation piece where a visitor downloads an app, and you use your phone as almost like a wand. Mm-hmm. And it produces different sounds depending on where you're standing in the room and how you gesture. And part of one of the things that came up as we were working on it was how can we imply what it's like to make a line for a visitor. Yeah. And so by gesturing with their phone, we found that people were following the lines. Mm-hmm. And then almost dancing in the gallery. Mm-hmm. And it brought a new type of attention to the work for the visitor. So, I mean, that was like dipping our toe in this vast possibility.
Well, we'll look for more developments along those lines.
I mean, collaboration is just a very different way of working, too. And I really enjoyed collaborating with those artists in particular because they were just brilliant.
So speaking of Bowdoin, you're artist in residence, which means you're also not just creating work, but interacting with students. So I thought there's probably some students here today, and you're rather accomplished mid-career artist at this point. So I wondered if you just had some advice or thoughts about what it, like, how to keep going as a young artist.
Yeah.
What are your secrets of success?
Work your tail off. Yeah. And get lost. Work your tail off and get lost. And I'm sure I have some other.
We were talking about like the part of the getting lost is just putting your head down and just producing work. Because then you're able to respond to what you've made and keep, it'll lead to the next thing.
Right. Like just understanding that that being an artist you are committed to a continuum and to like just seeing that through piece after piece, project after project, and also being aware of the sort of, I've learned to be aware of sort of to watch from a distance my experience of my successes and failures. Mm-hmm. So I've learned that I should never leave my studio empty. When I am getting ready to ship work off for an exhibition, I always make sure that I have something that's in progress so that I don't have to come back to an empty studio. Mm-hmm. You know, for a long time, I hated going on vacation because it was like forgetting to put the bookmarker in your book. You know, I would like lose my place. Yeah. And so I've found for me, it's important to like dog ear the page and in whatever way is working for me at that particular moment. And right now it means leaving work that's unfinished in the studio to come back to.
Yeah.
But that's just something that I learned by kind of like watching myself from above. And I think every artist is going to have, but it's just important to know that, like, you know, either you're the kind of artist that freaks out when you're installing, or you're the kind of artist that freaks out when you finish something and then you doubt everything. Or I think most artists have this weird complex where we think that we're like complete imbeciles and we also think we're geniuses. And so I toggle back and forth. And, you know, sometimes it feels like I come into the studio and I think, who was in here last night? And how did they ruin my brilliant work? You know, or I come and I go, who was in here last night? They just solved all my problems for me. So that's that toggling.
I think art history is the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Writing.
Yeah.
Writing. Like you said, you've reread the little piece that you wrote for Sheldon. And,
well, I have had that experience where I'm like, this catalog essay is actually really good. How did that happen? Yeah. So we have some time for questions. We'd love to hear. Yes.
So, hi. You've done works on mylar and panel and walls of different kinds. Can you talk about the advantages of each of those materials and the limitations of each of them in the drawings that you do?
Right. So.
We were asked to repeat the question.
Yes. Yep. So the question, that's fine. We were told
we knew ahead of time
the question. So Debbie asked the advantages and disadvantages of different substrates. Did I get that right? Okay. Well, I think the advantages of the wall drawings, just to start with that, are that it's not an object. So there are no considerations as far as preservation are concerned, or how delicate it is if I'm gonna have to ship it or something, you know, as mundane as that. So the wall drawing is kind of separate. And then then the other materials would be printmaking, which falls into works on paper, but it's a little different. Works on Mylar, which I worked almost exclusively on Mylar for probably 15 years. And then paintings on panels. And, you know, it's a bummer that artists have to think about this, but storage is an issue. And Mylar is great because it rolls up. So, you know, I have a very small storage area in my studio, and I can keep a lot of work rolled up in there. So that's really nice. I also just love Mylar. I mean, I love how luminous it is. And the panels that I'm working on now, for the past couple years, I've been doing a lot of paintings on panels, and there's just something about the like hardness of the edge that is so satisfying and also so deeply frustrating, and that's great. So I would say that that is the huge advantage of that material, but the disadvantage is the storage. Yeah, so,
yep.
Zach.
How has your professional experience as an artist informed your desire to create a space like the stable, and how do the two feed each other?
That's a great question. So Zach asked how my professional experience as an artist has driven me to be involved in community work, Stable in particular. So for those of you that don't know, Stable is a nonprofit here in Washington, D.C. that I co-founded with Caitlin Teal Price and Tim Dowd. And it is a 10,000 square foot space with studios and exhibition space. We'll be opening in early 2019. So being an artist is so solitary most of the time, and most of us like that, and I think it's important, but it's not good to work in a vacuum most of the time. You know, I mean, in the long run, I think that, and so. You know, here in Washington, we have these amazing museums. It's not like I can't get out and get sustenance, professional sustenance or, you know, creative sustenance. But there's something about being a part of a community that is so important. And, you know, for me, that means being part of an artist community or creative community or a community of people who think that that art making matters, that contemporary art making matters. And it is hard to balance the, you know, my life as a studio artist, as a professional artist, with my life as a kind of, I don't know, arts activist. I don't know what the right word is. But
impresario.
I'll take that. That sounds fancy. I'll take that. For me, it really just adds more to what I get from being a solo practitioner. Like whatever it is, however many hours I've poured into Stable along with my partners has come back to me like tenfold as far as what I've learned and how I have grown. So I don't know if that's really answering the question, but yeah.
Yes, sir.
So when you create a work on a wall and you know that it's going to have a finite life, do you go say goodbye? Do you finish? Can you talk about that?
Sure. So he asked, when I create a site-specific work that is impermanent, how do I deal with it when it's coming to a close, when the exhibition is coming to a close? Well, with the Hirschhorn piece, I left town. But that piece was up for a year and a half, so I had seen it a lot. And also because I live in the same city where the piece was. And I didn't actually leave town intentionally to not be here when it was being painted over, but it was convenient to not be here. I actually have footage of it being painted over, and it's so fantastic. I love that footage. I wanted to stick it in here, but it was going to be a little distracting. The piece, the exhibition at the University of Maryland that had the, because I did two different shows at the University of Maryland. The first one was with Jonathan, and the second one was, I was artist in residence there, and that was the one where I designed the architecture. that piece, I happened to be there on the day that the show was closing. And I needed to have one more meeting with one more curator before it came down. And so they allowed me to have the meeting while they began to take down one of the pieces. So I was actually there. I could hear them with the jackhammers, like with the, not actually jackhammers, but like. I didn't find it upsetting. I thought it was funny. I think when I'm finished making the piece, I have closure on it. So it's not so much of an issue for me. But again, I don't go and I'm not there while it's happening. Maybe I should be. Maybe I should try that sometime. Yeah.
Annetta.
Yeah.
Hi.
I want to follow up on that question. I feel that your ephemeral pieces are actually the framework for understanding all of your work. They provide sort of the theory behind what you're doing in the studio. If I understand you correctly, because I recall a conversation in which you spoke about breath. So maybe you can elaborate on that.
You're so perceptive because in our conversation on Friday, Lynn, we talked about sort of the different ways that she works, and she said if she were forced to choose, the wall drawings would be what she pursued. So I think you're right. Do you wanna?
Yeah. So the wall drawings certainly inform the work that I make in the studio in a way that nothing else can. There is this tension between the two, because the work I make in the studio is, you know, I'm very cognizant of the fact that I'm making objects that last and that can be moved, and they have so many, they're so different than the wall drawings. But All of the list of things that are so important to me that Jonathan read out at the beginning of this conversation, sensation, ephemerality,
labor,
and I can't remember the other one.
Mm-hmm. Entropy.
Yeah. All of those things are in the work in the studio, but I get to demonstrate them in a different way with the wall drawings. The wall drawings are dependent on an institution. So I can keep making whatever I want to make in the studio, but I have to be invited by an institution to do a wall drawing. And so there's that extra piece, that extra piece of complexity, that extra layer that is a part of that process, really. Right. So
I was really thinking on Friday, I didn't say it out loud, but I was, as we were talking about that very issue, I was really thinking about Christo and Jean-Claude, because he would make these objects and sell them so that they could do these monumental pieces. And in a way, you're
there's a I mean, bit I think I sort of said that. I think I may have sort of said that in a lot of ways, the work that I make in the studio is supporting the wall drawings.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
On the same tack, I've noticed at least in these slides, the wall drawings are titled, but the studio works are untitled. Is that a stylistic choice, or is there something about audience reception?
So Larry asked why the wall drawings are titled and the works that I make in the studio are not titled. And that's true. The only works that I title are the site-specific pieces. So what happened was, at a certain point, I realized that I wanted the shows to be titled. I want my exhibitions to have titles. And that's like another little piece of generosity of like, this is what I'm thinking about this body of work, or, you know, without nailing it down. Because if one of my paintings were to be titled, I feel like it just kind of shuts down certain paths that a viewer might potentially have. Mm-hmm. So the exhibitions are titled, and when an exhibition is a wall drawing, it means that title then transfers to the wall drawing. So I just made a decision somewhere along the way that I will commit to titling the wall drawings. But I'm also very committed to not titling the paintings and drawings that I make in the studio.
So you mentioned the four things, and remember I added a fifth one, attention.
Yeah.
So I think I'd like to thank the audience for the generosity of their attention, and we'll stop there.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.